You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. In the years leading up to the American Civil War, there was plenty of political jockeying and struggles for influence, particularly by Southern states, in focusing on steering American foreign policy. Their interest was protecting their peculiar institution known as slavery. Southern states did not want a global trend of ending the inhumane lifelong bondage of another human being for profit to creep onto American shores. So how did this shape America in these delicate years? How did this become important and towards the annexation of Texas? And how does this examination of these events shatter the pretense that the American Civil War was about anything other than the Southern's insistence on preserving slavery, on the South's insistence on preserving slavery? A new book out today takes a deep dive into this area. It's called This Vast Southern Empire, Slaveholders at the Helm of American Foreign Policy. And we're joined by the author, Matthew Karp, Assistant Professor of History at Princeton University. And Matthew, hi, welcome to The Source.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Our phone lines are open. You can give us a call if you've got a question or comment about this interesting period in American history, 210-614-8980, and email questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org. And Matthew, so this is a very interesting angle of approach, looking at this incredibly interesting period in American history. Certainly we're familiar with the lead up to the Civil War, but not through this lens. How did you come to decide to write about this particular way?
You know, it's funny. It's sort of embarrassing how long this project has sort of gestated. You know, over a decade. I think I was an undergraduate. I was taking a history class in England for study abroad, and you know, the professor said something about in the Mexican War, Mexico offering the province of California to Great Britain in exchange for possible assistance against the United States. And it just sort of set my mind going, thinking about the whole North American continent and the Western Hemisphere as a kind of field of action for sort of international strategic struggle between the great powers and the place of slavery, especially in that struggle. And, I mean, you know, it's not the first person to think about things in those terms, but I think we have to remember that this argument about slavery in the United States between Northerners and Southerners, or you know, pro-slavery, anti-slavery, was an argument that was being had all around the world, or at least all around the Atlantic world, in Latin America, in the Caribbean, in Europe, and it involved West Africa, and in some ways, it indirectly involved Asia. So I think it really is important to look at it from an international perspective.
So you write about how American foreign policy became to be dominated by Southern slaveholders, that they were the majority, vast majority of ministers, foreign ministers. I guess that was like ambassadors at the time. Was this a deliberate strategy by the South as a way to help preserve slavery?
Well, the way I think about it is, if you think about the world in the 1830s, especially from my book, the 1840s and 50s, right up to the Civil War, the dominant global power was Great Britain. And when Great Britain abolished slavery in 1833, and it, you know, it sort of took a while to enact, it really changed the international balance of power in regard to slavery. And I do think we should think about things in terms of an international balance of power, because Southerners, slaveholders, certainly did. And it meant that the world's largest navy, the world's most powerful empire, the world's largest economy was suddenly, in a sense, on the side of anti-slavery. You know, when a slave ship crashed on a British, you know, in the Bahamas or something, then, you know, Great Britain would free the slaves. And it meant that the United States, for, you know, slaveholding Americans, had to sort of get serious from their perspective about defending slavery, not just, you know, from Northern abolition, which at that point was comparatively really weak, but from British abolition globally. So Southerners, I think, starting in the administration of John Tyler in early 1840s, really got motivated to sort of think about the United States as the strongest existing slave power, the strongest nation that had slavery at the time, and, you know, trying to build up the American Navy, the U.S. military, and establish relationships with other slaveholding societies like the Empire of Brazil and Spain, whose colony Cuba was another really dynamic slave society at this period. So I think that's when it was sort of really in response to the British threat that these guys launched what I don't think it's crazy to say was a kind of Cold War-like orientation in American foreign policy, where the United States was going to mount this ideological and strategic defense of slavery against the British threat.
And so how did Great Britain come to have emancipation in 1833?
Well, I mean, the situation for slavery in Britain in British colonies was obviously very different. You know, there was a long history of anti-slavery activism in Great Britain as early as the late 18th century. Lord Mansfield's court ruling had determined that there were no you couldn't have a British a slave on British soil proper in England or Great Britain, and so the colonies in the West Indies, you know, Jamaica, Barbados, etc., were you know, very profitable sugar growing places, but over the course of the early 19th century, I think it's safe to say they were much less fundamental to the British economy and to the sort of British imperial power than Southern slavery in the United States. So anti-slavery activists had both a longer tradition to draw on and a weaker opposition in their effort to abolish slavery.
Today, there's always this argument about what was really the Civil War, what was it really about, and we hear from some defenders of the South who say that that slavery really was on its way out, that eventually the United States would have followed Great Britain's lead with their emancipation of in 1833. It was just a matter of time, and that that was, and that's proof of their point that Great Britain did do that, they did set their slaves free. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. I think people like that obviously haven't spent much time, you know, reading the words of slaveholders themselves, because these guys were far from bashful or apologetic about slavery and its position in the world. If you read Jefferson Davis, if you read Alexander Stevens, the vice president of the eventual Confederacy and a Georgia senator, if you read John C. Calhoun, if you read any of the important Southerners who really were in charge of Southern politics and, in a sense, American politics, they were constantly boasting about slavery's economic significance and its global economic power, not just through King Cotton. I mean, we know about King Cotton, and certainly cotton was the most important crop in Texas, but and in the United States. But you know, Cuban sugar and Brazilian coffee were all undergoing major export booms in this period. And from a Southern perspective, the entire world economy, the industrializing world of the 19th century, really couldn't do without coerced labor on the model of African slavery. And slaveholders, you know, they were constantly, the DeBow's Review, which is out of James D. DeBow, who was a really important Southern editor in New Orleans, actually and superintendent of the U.S. Census, and he was a sort of statistically minded guy. And he would put out all these projections about the amount of slaves in the United States going forward into future years. At one point, he got up to something like 1910, and there would be, you know, 13 million slaves or something like that in the U.S. They were not projecting this institution to die out, far from it.
Actually, it sounds like it was getting stronger. This vast Southern empire, slaveholders at the helm of American foreign policy. We're speaking with the author, Matthew Karp. You've got a question, comment, number is 210-614-8980. The source continues after this break. Stay tuned. Before the U.S. Civil War, American foreign policy had a lopsided presence of Southern slaveholders on a mission to save their peculiar institution, slavery, and their crowning achievement was the annexation of Texas into the Union as a slave state. But things could have gone very differently, and Texas could have had a very different future. We read about it in the new book, This Vast Southern Empire, Slaveholders at the Helm of American Foreign Policy. Matthew Karp is the author. He's our guest this half hour for The Source, and we invite you to call in. If you've got a question or a comment about this interesting segment of American history, 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. And let me ask you, Matthew, about Texas, and why did this figure so prominently in the shaping of the foreign policy at the time?
Yeah, Texas is really important. I mean, actually, even before it became a state, when it was an independent republic, in the early 1840s, from the perspective of U.S. Slaveholders, John C. Calhoun, who was Secretary of State, before him Abel Upshur, who was a Virginia-born Secretary of State, they really saw Texas as a kind of front line in this struggle between American slavery and British abolition, as a kind of vulnerable, fledgling republic that was, you know, strong enough to get away from Mexico, which, by the way, was anti-slavery. So that, you know, where slavery had been outlawed pretty much in Mexico. So that was a sort of fault line between the Texas-Mexico border between slavery and abolition. But Texas was strong enough to sort of beat Mexico, but maybe not strong enough to survive indefinitely or to be to avoid being coaxed into a kind of British orbit where Britain would recognize Texas's independence in exchange for a promise to abolish slavery. And slavery was growing in Texas rapidly in the 40s, but it wasn't solid in the way that it was in, say, South Carolina or Mississippi yet. So these American foreign policymakers were really keen to secure both to add Texas to the republic for the reasons we all know about, you know, that it would expand America's borders and strengthen the United States continentally and so on, but also especially, I think, to protect slavery in Texas from this British threat or this British temptation, because Texas President Sam Houston really, he flirted. He said he coquetted with Great Britain about this. And people like John C. Calhoun, Secretary of State from South Carolina, were really keen to make sure that that didn't happen. So they worked night and day to bring Texas into the Union in 1844, 1845.
All right, Jesse is on the line, 210-614-8980, if you want to call in. And Jesse, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, my question was regarding the entrance of the revolution in Texas have to do with retaining slavery after Mexico abolished it. I believe that the 1824 Constitution, it was legal to own slaves, but there was a later constitution that outlawed it.
All right, Jesse, thank you for the call. Sure. So how did the slavery play a role in the Texas War for Independence? And talk about that some.
Yeah. In 1829, there was another Mexican constitution that more or less outlawed slavery. Now, Mexican leaders were in a sense quite willing to tolerate Texas as an exception to that rule. I mean, I don't think there was much presence on the ground from the Mexican government to sort of outlaw forcibly or to abolish any slaves in Texas. But I think there was a legitimate question among Texan slaveholders as to how long their institution could survive under the rule of a government whose constitution outlawed it. So I think that definitely played a role in the Texas Revolution. And certainly it played a role in the way that Americans viewed that revolution and, either chose to support it or certainly thought about the ongoing wars between Texas and Mexico after the revolution. I think I remember an American congressman saying, you know, the Army of Santa Anna marches into Mexico as avowed abolitionists. And that's certainly how they saw that struggle ongoing between Texas and Mexico, which kind of, flared up over the course of the late 1830s, early 1840s until annexation.
And people in the South celebrated Texas independence. How did they see it?
I think they did. You could ask why didn't Texas won its independence in 1836, and Andrew Jackson was president. He later became, he's a key figure in the ultimate drive for annexation. But when he was president, he didn't push for it right away. So Southerners were extremely, enthusiastic about Texas winning its independence and were in favor of annexation from the beginning. But they were afraid about upsetting the political apple cart because a lot of Northerners were leery about accepting another slave state. And those domestic politics played into the sort of wariness. It wasn't until the early 1840s when Britain really started meddling in Texas in the eyes of slaveholders, that it became urgent enough to risk this political collision with the North in order to acquire, in order to annex the Texan Republic. So that's another way that foreign affairs, I think, shaped you know, when and how Texas got annexed.
Yeah, but you write that one Southern gentleman celebrated the Texas victory over Mexico. He saw it as a victory for white supremacy and for security of the slave of holding the slave property.
Yeah. No, exactly. And that you know, these Southerners in, you know, places like Louisiana or Mississippi or Arkansas were constantly afraid of a sort of encirclement, where Great Britain, which, you know, in fairness, was this sort of preponderant global power that had resources and agents and so on everywhere, that Great Britain could sort of foment a kind of anti-slavery, maybe even anti-white alliance between Mexicans, Indians, and maybe escaped or rebelling slaves, and that this would sort of encircle and destroy or at least harass American slaveholders. So they really needed to summon the power of the U.S. government in order to sort of defeat that potential alliance. I mean, this is something that, and these weren't like marginal fears. You know, Andrew Jackson was worried about this, was writing about this all the time, this prospect of some kind of British-inspired slave Indian anti-white army.
Okay, another caller from Winnetka. And Winnetka, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good to have the discussion. I'm a 12th generation Tejana, Catholic, of course, and I was wondering if the author has come across his studies regarding the fact that President Polk sent the U.S. Army on Navy ships down to Veracruz to invade and violate the sovereignty of Mexico. And as a law-abiding, or we call ourselves a nation of that abides by the rule of law, I wonder how I could explain that little transgression.
So Winfred Scott, okay, thank you. So Winfred Scott goes to Veracruz during Polk's War, which is the American-Mexican War, while Zachary Taylor invades from the land.
Yeah, you know, and I think the caller is right to highlight that aspect of the war, because if you think about American history, American military history from a longer run perspective, it's a really daring, ambitious, and certainly from the perspective of Mexico, aggressive, illegal maneuver to not just fight this, you know, because the war in Mexico breaks out over the boundary, over, you know, Mexico has said that the Texas boundary is the Sabine River. Texas claims the Rio Grande, and so there's and the U.S. inherits Texas's like maximum claim. And President Polk is really pushy about this, and he sort of provokes Mexico, I think, into when he sends Taylor's army across the Sabine into the Rio Grande. But you know, you could have fought a limited war at that border. You know, you could have taken, if you were Polk, if you were just interested in sort of continental empire, you could have, you know, you could have taken all the land that the United States did take from Mexico, California, New Mexico, and so on, and not necessarily done anything more. But I think it does speak to the sort of ambition and the geopolitical confidence and sort of aggression of especially these sort of Southern Democratic leaders, that that he okayed Scott's expedition to not just conquer, not just like sort of take this, lop off the northern half of Mexico, but invade and subdue the Mexican heartland, which is not really, I think you'd argue that it's in some ways the strategically most ambitious thing that the U.S. Army did until the 20th century in a lot of ways.
And occupy Mexico City from the halls of Montezuma.
Yeah.
So what did Taylor do in his last hours of the presidency to secure the Texas annexation? And there's questions about the constitutionality of that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, again, you know, the sort of one of the great narratives or threads of American history is, you know, Southerners are always, you know, since Jefferson or whatever, have fetishized or at least emphasized a strict constitutional, strict interpretation of the Constitution and the primacy of state rights. And if you look at how this sort of ongoing conflict between slavery and abolition plays out in foreign policy, you don't really see a lot of that. Taylor, when he's confronted with, he first attempts in 1844 to get Texas in through an annexation treaty, through a treaty which has to pass the Senate by a two-third vote. That gets shot down. And then in the waning hours of his presidency, after Polk's been elected and everyone thinks, okay, well, Polk's elected, we're going to try again, he successfully pushes a bill through Congress to bring in Texas as a state just by joint resolution. That's a 50-50 thing. And he squeaks in enough votes and drags Texas in sort of with the presumption that everybody involved is going to wait for Polk to sort of see this through. Tyler acts immediately and brings Texas in the waning hours of his presidency, or at least brings Texas in. And, you know, there's still negotiations that take place for the next year. But it's really striking because a lot of Southerners are sort of saying to themselves, you know, in 1803 when we got the Louisiana Purchase, some people thought that it was unconstitutional to do that without an amendment to bring in this millions of miles of new land. And now to bring in Texas, we don't have to do an amendment. We don't have to do a treaty. We just have to have a majority in Congress to do this. And right. Southerners were at the forefront, pro-slavery Southerners were at the forefront of overriding these kinds of philosophical or abstract objections to the necessity. Sorry.
Matthew Karp, thank you so much. I've heard secessionists, Texas secessionists, bring that up, saying that Texas was never properly brought into the Union. And that this vast Southern Empire is the name of the book. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you.